Mijn naam is Rudolf Guis. In die stormachtige apartheidsjaren, I'm doing this slowly in Afrikaans for you, PJ. Dus PJ is door bewonderaars in Zuid-Afrika se townships herdoop as Tandeka. Sy het in die tyd reeds roem gewerf in die muziekbedrijf. Nou, PJ het een baie belangrike rol gespeel in die versoening om te help bewerkstellig met die oorgang na demokrasie in Zuid-Afrika. Ek het vanoggend toevallig met Marty Meiring gesels, waar gesê dat ek nou hier net vir hulle gaan voorstel. Toe sê sy vir my, PJ het die swart mense in die land oorrompel. En sy kan nie genoeg sê wat so belangrike rol PJ gespeel het in daai tyd nie. Meneer Nelson Mandela het haar uitgesonde as een van sy gunsteling sangeresse en daarom verwelkom ons haar met die bekendstelling van haar boek haar levensverhaal, Here I Am. Die gesprek word gelei deur Yvonne Johnston, wat ek ook al vir 'n baie lang tyd ken en ek wil vir albei van julle baie welkom sê en hulle gaan hulle best doen om Engels te praat volgende. Hulle sukkel maar 'n bietjie daarmee.
Baie dankie, Rudolf. Baie dankie.
Baie dankie, Rudolf.
Morning, everybody. Morning. Please excuse us, but we're not fluent enough to speak in Afrikaans, so please bear with us. Morning, PJ.
Morning. Morning. Jammer vir my Afrikaans, maar I'm too shy to praat.
So, it's 6 months since your book was launched.
Uh-huh.
How has that impacted your life? How has writing a book and the resulting publishing of it impacted on your life?
It's been a slow, gradual kind of burn. First of all, when I woke up one morning and decided that I wanted to write a book, first of all, I never realized that it would be as hard as it was, because it was a personal journey. You get caught up in the excitement of writing the book and the fear of telling what is truly, truly precious and intimate and vulnerable. I'm not good at showing my vulnerable side. And then you get caught up in the promotion of it, and then suddenly you realize what you've written and you think, oh, shit, somebody's reading this, you know. And I suppose there are times when I'm out public and I think, what have I done? And there are times when I'm very proud at what I've achieved and what I have managed to let go of and let the South African public know about my life.
What did you learn about yourself when you were writing the book?
That I'm a complete narcissist. That I I think that's kind of in the last chapter, it's not a chapter, in the takeout of my book, I've written my doggy bag. And I suppose what I learned more than anything is that I have tended to rush through my life. And that's what I learned most about myself, is that I didn't really see any roses, let alone stop to smell it, them.
I've heard Marianne say, and I've heard you say to Marianne, that she dug very, very deeply. If you had written the book alone and you hadn't had Marianne's penetrating gaze looking at you, do you think the book would have been different? Is there stuff that Marianne dug out that's landed up in the book that might not have been there otherwise?
Heck, you can't believe. Marianne is an incredible writer. She goes to places and she's enabled in a very kind and generous, gentle way. To be able to dig, and we had lots of altercations during this book, because I said, I don't want to go there, the public is not interested in this. And she said, how many books have you written? And I said, none. And she said, well, I think I know, having written a lot of bestsellers, I know what the public want to read. And it wasn't about what the public wanted to read. It's, I think, if I had written this book, to answer your question, I think it would have been quite glib, and it would have been, When you read the content of, we're going to get to the parts, I should imagine you're going to get to the parts. It was kind of like the cream on an Irish coffee. That's what I would have written about. Mariana's has got right there into the dark part of the Irish coffee, and she's gone deep, and she's, I am more honest than I have ever been in my life, and she went to places that I never in my dream imagined that I would go, and I feel extremely liberated because of it. and I'm thrilled that I've done it. You know, I don't want to use that word cathartic because it's so overused, but I do feel a sense of freedom. Yeah.
And when I know you, and so when I read the book, it sounds very much as if it's your voice, and yet the actual words were penned by somebody else. Mm. So talk to me about the relationship that you had with Marianne in this, because it appears to me that she really lived inside you and reflected you very honestly and very authentically.
Well, you see, the process was, we're two very strong women, and that was the joy of getting Marianne as a co-writer, was because I didn't have to explain anything to Marianne. She's the same age, she had the same political views, she had the same frame of reference, the same music, we knew the same music and all that sort of thing. And so what we would do is we would sit for hours. I mean, I don't know how this woman does this kind of thing. And she would tape me, but she never had that tape recorder off. And what we decided was, right up at the beginning, she said, the tape recorder is always on unless you ask me to turn it off. And let me tell you that this is why I always used to poo-poo reality shows and go, ah, please, man, that's not possible. But now I realize how quickly you forget when a tape recorder is on. Like, for example, the tape recorder would be on in the car. And I would go, are you taping this? She said, yes, you didn't tell me to turn it off. So it's that kind of thing. So
and anything that was on the tape could go into the book.
Anything that was in the tape could go into the book. That was the contract. Otherwise, I had to say, turn off the tape. So very quickly, 2 days in, you're forgetting about the tape recorder. So what Marianne would do was then she would go and transcribe. And as we got really into the book, after about the first month, she realized not to transcribe too much, because then I would rake through it with this like eagle eye and just word for word. For example, she used the word ass. I'd come down the stairs on my ass. And I said, I would never use the word ass. It's not, that's not my language. You know, you have to write this in my language. She said, you're being pedantic. I said, I'm not. You have to write this in my voice. So we to and fro for about a day on the word ass. And and eventually we...
You obviously won because it's not in the book.
No, it's not in the book. I always win. And when it came to the book, you know, I had to win. It's my voice. And we settled on backside, which I think just sounds easier.
I must say, as a reader of the book, there's a profound authenticity.
Thank you.
I mean, and I think that's what all the reviews have said, is that this book is a very authentic voice. So obviously you found each other very clearly. So I just want to shift gears now, because the book is not just about you. It's about the history of South Africa in that time. And what was interesting was that there are not many books written about the history of that time. So as anybody of our sort of age is reading it, it takes you back to these beautiful visual memories one has of the 80s and 90s. And a lot of it is about the politics, because you almost became a sort of quasi-political figure. So my question to you is, does music influence politics, or does politics influence music, and how did the two come together?
Sure, you're clever, eh? you know, the answer to that question is I don't know. I know from my experience is that what happened was I was in a rock band, and I wrote a funny little love song called You're So Good to Me. And it went onto the Radio Zulu Charts, which was a vernacular station, excuse me, at a time where, I mean, English just was not played. And I was invited into Soweto on the 31st of May in 82. Thank you. You've read the book. 1982, and I was given the name Tandeka, and because of that, I started to go. I was in the townships a lot, and injustice is something that I can't bear. I couldn't bear it then, and I can't bear it now. And I think that I became political, and people have called me an activist, and I suppose I was a justice activist. I don't think that I was a political activist. I became an activist of justice, and that is what I wanted to see. I wanted to see fairness in my country, and that is where my activism, I'd like to place it there as opposed to political activism.
Your songs do have a sort of a political bent to them, or put it this way. I mean, when I read the chapter about you driving the Pantechnicon into the townships, there was a sense that you were trying to maybe alleviate the politics.
Well, I mean, the country was burning. It was a terrible time in our country. And, you know, I do believe that that if you lose hope in a country, then you've lost everything. You may as well pack up and go home, you know, turn off the lights. And we were precariously close to doing that in the late 80s. And what we decided in our absolute innocence and madness was that we would go into the townships and sing. I mean, Molotov cocktails were flying around, and there were bullets, and it was really, it was insanity. But what we provided was a feeling for those people that in the middle of this craziness they had not been forgotten. And what we also provided was the most important thing for the people that lived in the townships, was a feeling that there was hope. And there was a sense of music, and that they, irrespective of what was going on in the townships, we could still dance, we could still sing, we could still see a light. We could, and I believe that still, strange enough, it's still applicable 21 years later. If we lose hope, what are we going to do, you know? Mm. That's why my new slogan, by the way, is if you can't love here, don't live here.
We'll get to that a little later, because clearly the energy hasn't dissipated. If you, any of you, watch PJ in action, or walk down the street with her, or walked into a township, or walked into a shopping centre, you would see that, and it's a remarkable phenomenon, she's almost universally loved, by old, by young, by black, by white, by Indian, by coloured, it's almost a universal kind of feeling of love comes towards PJ, which is a remarkable thing. What do you think is it that allows you to create that amazing magic that you have, that attracts everybody? I mean, I've just never seen it. It's completely universal. What it is it inside you that attracts people?
You know, it's only recently since I wrote the book that I've started to analyze that question, because people have asked me so often. First of all, I must just tell you I feel extremely grateful and extremely blessed. I think that when I was young, I had no expectation of anyone, and I had no preconceived ideas of anyone. And what I did was I happily went about loving everyone, you know. And I know this sounds very sort of childish, but that's what I did. And I do think that it all boils down to love. At the end of the day, that's the bottom line. And I did. Now I think that I just get what I project. Actually, you know, it's not some foreign concept that I've worked out, and it's not something that I've designed, and it's not something I don't think I've been touched on the
She's
shoulder.
She's stumbling over this. She's being far too humble.
No, but I don't think I've been touched by some sort of, you know, wand. But I do believe that, you know, what you put out is what you're going to get. And if you walk around looking grim and expecting everybody to rob you, you're going to get people that are grim in your life, and you're going to be robbed. But in terms of me, I was born, by the way, with one of those things over, what do they call it, a cowl? And also that thing around my neck. So, you know, I'm here for the grace of God. Eh? And I just am a lucky so-and-so. I really am.
PJ, the opening chapter of your book is, for me, one of the most compelling chapters, opening chapters of any book I've ever read in my life, and I've read thousands. And it talks about your descent into alcoholism and the almost close-to-death experience. Talk to us a bit about that descent and the rise from it into sobriety. How did you get there? How did you get there?
He hasn't had enough sleep. I think that how I got there was, I don't think, I know. You know, what happened to me was I came from this very, very close family. I was the last of four children by 6 years. Very, very close knit. We associated a very protected environment. I never wanted for anything, love or materially. And I came up to Johannesburg, and my career happened very fast for me. And thank you. And then I was called, my real name is Penelope Jane Dunlop. I mean, it sounds like from Downton Abbey, doesn't it? So that's why we changed to PJ Powers. And basically what happened was everything happened very quickly. It really did. It happened very fast for me. And then I was called PJ Powers, which I loved, you know. And
I think PJ Dunlop on stage could have been...
No, can you imagine the headlines? PJ Dunlop, you know, you should have seen me then if you think I'm big now. Rolls onto stage, you know, like a tire. No. Powers has been fantastic. Powers her way to the top. Powers is a good surname for me, but Dunlop would not have been good. And I mean, when have you ever heard of a pop or rock star called Penelope? So PJ, you know, is the P, and Powers is fantastic. And then I was given the second identity by the black people of South Africa.
You're going off the subject now. We're talking about alcoholism.
Tandeka. Wait, I'm getting there. Which was Tandeka. And those are the two people I looked after. Okay. I took great care. There was great discipline. There was great love shown from me to Tandeka and PJ Powers. But not for a second did I pay any attention to Penelope Jane Dunlop. And after many, many years of hits, and many years of earning a lot of money, I woke up one day when I was about 39, and I didn't write a hit. And it was like, oh, this is a novel concept. I've written something that people don't like. And they didn't like it, and they didn't like the next one either. And it started this sort of, it was after the Rugby Cup, the World Cup rugby, and it started this downward spiral. And I was never interested in alcohol, ever. But then I discovered that magic of something that could take the edge off the pain that I was feeling, because I felt I was losing my grip. And Penelope Jane just didn't exist. I didn't know how to tend to her. And we all know that it went from there, from just being a party drunk to, at the end, I drank a bottle of hairspray and nearly died in hospital with two alcohol-induced seizures. So, you know, I've been given the second chance, and I am celebrating. I'm in my sixth year of sobriety, and I sit here, I think, a better person, and on a journey, a completely different one, I'm very grateful to be where I am. But how that happened is I completely understand now.
Have you learned any lessons from going on that journey?
Yes. The most important lessons and the most worthwhile, and the ones that I will use in my life going forward, definitely the biggest learning curve. The 12-step program, which I am in, I still go to AA twice a week, and that 12-step program, I think, should be obligatory. I think it should be in all school. This is how we should live our lives, you know, is living in the moment for today. Well, today is what counts, you know. What counts to me today is that I'm sitting with you people and you here today. That's what counts for me.
But it wasn't such an easy journey for you. I mean, the book tells of 5 visits to rehab centers.
Oh, yeah. It was a terrible 7 years of trying to get sober. You know, 5 rehabs later. I mean, I used to check in, and then I didn't even have to sign in. They used to send me to my old room. And I say that glibly now and with a smile on my face, but at the time, every time I went in, I hated myself more. And I couldn't understand how I would come out and have 3 years of sobriety and a bucket load of good intention. And somehow, I remember spending a Christmas with my parents in Durban. And I got in my car in Durban, and I'd had 3 months of sobriety. And I said goodbye to everyone with absolutely no, I don't know what, but I happened to drive past a bottle store. This is the serpent-like nature of addiction. This is what follows you for the rest of my life, will follow me. And I happened to pass a bottle store. And I stopped. And I got out, and I went, and I bought 2 bottles of vodka. And I arrived in Johannesburg. I drove. Huh? And I arrived in Johannesburg 11 hours later. How? I lost complete, probably Moy River is probably where I remember.
Last consciousness.
The last place I remember, yeah. And that was about it. Mm. So, I mean, it's crazy. It's just really crazy.
Talk to us about that firefly moment.
Yeah, I have a one-woman show called Firefly, which actually I'm doing at Franschhoek. And what happened was I was in hospital, and my sister was with me through this entire thing. She was the last man standing, and she saw me through everything. And I'd had these two after drinking the Flex hairspray. We went to hospital, and I was convulsing. Heard my sister say to the doctor, "Is she going to die?" And I heard the doctor say, "I don't know, but we're doing everything that we can." And I suddenly thought, I don't want to die. I had been planning my suicide for years, about 2 years. And I suddenly thought to myself, I don't want to die. That's the last thing I want to do, you know. So I suddenly found myself. That's why I called my show The Firefly, because a room and a situation has to be completely dark and black in order to see a firefly. And that was the light that I followed, and I followed it into 6 years of sobriety. And I hope that it's still there when the light goes out tonight, you know.
Well, we're very glad that you did.
Thank you.
You know, this book takes you on a wonderful journey, because obviously there's quite a lot of pain, which we've sort of touched on briefly. But it's also a book that has stories that will make you laugh out loud. And so it definitely takes you on that journey from pain to joy. And there's some very, very funny stories in them that I just want to remind you. I want PJ to tell you the story, the funniest story for me, of what I call the furniture store phase, when the fame had disappeared and she was trekking around the country every Saturday morning and performing to whoever was coming to buy a Blumen mattress in Bears and in Joshua Dorr. And there's a very funny story in there of the man from Ventersdorp. So maybe you can tell that story.
I did. You know, there I was. After having done Jabalani and Feel So Strong and everything, singing and all these things. If you buy this now, you don't have to pay any deposit. But, you know, your first installment will only be in 3 months' time. But, I was in Ventersdorp. And I was singing, I think it was Bears or Russell's, your two-year guarantee store, or something, I don't know. And I was singing away. And the people started to rush at the store. And they were, the store was full, and then one of the glass windows broke. And there were just masses. It was starting to build up to sort of a riot situation outside. And this guy, Johan, came and said, "PJ, I'll pay your money. I'll do anything. Just fuck off."
Because in that crowd, there was not a single person who really wanted to buy a mattress.
I'm having looting, my windows are breaking, just fuck off.
And, there's a delightful story that I'm not going to tell you about, because I want you to buy the book, about PJ lying on a sunbed with Sharon Stone, which is a terrifying, terrifying thought. But I also loved, and I laughed out loud at the stories of Brenda Fassie. who had such an amazing energy and amazing presence. And there are two stories. Maybe you'd like to tell one of the Brenda Fassi stories from the book.
Tell the one about the dressing room.
Yes, tell them about the dressing room.
Brenda was an amazing human being. She was a friend of mine, and she was a loose cannon, and she was all of those things. She was amazingly talented. But she took no from anyone. You know, she was so in herself and so completely forthright and irreverent. It was frightening. But anyway, I was busy doing a show with Jaluka at the time in Johannesburg. And I remember, or maybe I was supporting Millie Jackson, actually, I can't remember. But I came backstage, and there was this, like, drunk, how I would have described her at the time was a dark colored. You know, I couldn't make out whether she was black or colored, you know, that kind of thing. And she was lying on my chair in my dressing room like this. And I thought, who's this woman lying in my dressing room? And she had no teeth, not one tooth in her mouth. And she was completely three sheets to the wind. And I said to her, what are you doing in my dressing room? And she got up and she said, I just want to tell you, one day I'm going to be a star than you have ever seen in your life. And I said, okay. And I ran out, I got my manager, and I said, Mike, there's something going on in my dressing room. Really, get this woman out of my face. And 3 months later, I looked on the television and I thought, it can't be. And there Brenda had bought herself a set of teeth, and she was up on the television singing in a program that we used to have called Mkumkabela, and she was singing, I'm your weekend special. And there she was, this famous, dynamite, fantastic little performer. And that's what Brenda was like. I mean, she asked Eric Clapton, but that's too rude. Yeah, I can't. Yeah, it's better if you read that part.
Better read that story. Yeah. So you're painting a story that maybe is a bit of a mental leap for a reader, because as an outsider looking in on this business of show business, you think it's so glamorous. Is it glamorous?
You know, first of all, yes, I'm so glad that thank you for the questions you've asked, because this book isn't about me. It's about the politics of the country. It's about how I, as a white woman, suddenly was embraced by the people of South Africa at that time. It's about my relationship with Nelson Mandela, which was brilliant. It's a long, sort of protracted. But in terms of glamour, I did go into it. Oh, my dear, I was 5 years old, and I used to follow my sister around the house saying, please interview me, because in my head I was a famous singer, not a singer, a famous singer. And all I could see was limousines and mirrors with those lights around them. Yes, one of those. But all I wanted was one of those mirrors with the lights around them, badly. And those kind of things. And I've still just sit in front in the dressing room. I mean, I'm lying, but very few. I mean, I perfected the art of going to do number one in a checkers bag, because if you're on the other side on stage and you're backstage and there are 50,000 people and there are no toilet facilities backstage, are you going to walk through the crowd to go to the loo on the other side? I don't think so. So, in fact, I can give you, as recently as last week, it was provided, I took a picture of it, what was provided for me in my dressing room. As an ablution block, and there is no glamour in this business. There's this. I mean, I'm surprised that every single person in the music industry and in the world of art is not bipolar, because one week you feel like Tina Turner, well, I do, and the next minute I think, what is that bit of slime on the pavement? Oh, it's me. And so it is a really, really odd career, but it's worth every single minute of it. But no, there is no glamour. I'm still waiting. If anyone wants to chuck some my way, I'll take it.
But we like the fantasy that it's glamorous.
Oh, the fantasy. I try to keep up the fantasy.
We like the fantasy that it's glamorous. There's a large chunk of the book dedicated to Mike Fuller, who was your first manager. which seems to have been a very fractious relationship, or it certainly is now. And the overall takeout is that managers exploit artists. And my reading of it is that Mike Fuller absolutely exploited you. How did that come about? What has he actually done? What has he done with your money? Maybe you could tell us a bit of that story.
Okay, I'm hoping like hell there's some journalists in this house. because feel free. It's an ongoing, in the book you'll see, it is an ongoing battle. In fact, just recently we sent letters off. Basically, you know, when I was 18 and I signed my contract with Mike Fuller, all I wanted to do was sing, huh? You could have said to me, actually, you're going to earn no money for the first 5 years of your career. And I said, it's fine, so long as I can sing. And my father said to me, Penelope, you can't possibly sign this contract. Well, he had to sign it because I was underage. So he said to me, I cannot sign this contract. Because what Mike was asking me to do was he was wanting to be my record company, my publisher, and my management. So he was wearing three hats. So he had complete autonomy and signing power.
So he'd have to have a conversation with himself.
He'd have to have a conversation. Like a manager is meant to do battle with the record company for the highest percentage for the artist. Mike would be running around the desk, you see, of course. So
getting the highest percentage for himself.
For himself, yeah. And anyway, basically I screamed and threw the most horrendous tantrum. My father eventually signed. I then re-signed without reading at 21 my contract with Mike Fuller, which he then was so, you know, it was a signed contract. But what has happened subsequently is he has not accounted to me. You know, I was the songwriter in Hotline, so I wrote all and continue to write all the original music. And now, of course, with my original music, he doesn't have a say, but he owns the publishing on all of that stuff. Now, for example, I have not earned 1 cent. I know that you people will find this difficult to understand or believe from the World in Union, the Rugby World Cup song. Not 1 cent, not one brass farthing. The record company pays him. Samro, so that pays him, he's meant to pay me. It's a long involved story and he has not accounted to me. So we're in a huge dispute. It's terribly complicated. But more than that, more than the money that he stole from me, which I'm hoping to regain some of it, what he did was he stole my sense of self-worth. Mike used to say to me when we were traveling abroad, he used to say, don't walk through the door before the other record company executives, because we don't want them to see your backside. So I was like, I used to stand there thinking, well, what am I supposed to do? They're all men. They're standing back so that I was the only woman. I can walk through. What am I supposed to stand back as well? So he gave me these huge complexes, and he kept me just insecure enough to stay with him. Subsequently, I stayed with him for 15 years. You know, I believe that the only reason I could sing was because of him. But you know, the good news
I wonder if he's read the book. It would be very nice to know whether he's read the book.
Well, he would never take me on, you see. Yeah. That's why everybody said, I mean, Penguin was saying, oh, yeah, legal ramifications. I said, don't worry, this guy will never take us on because he doesn't want it to be public. He's like a submarine, you know. He probably read the book and then just went down.
PJ, let's talk about your writing of songs. You still writing today?
Oh, yeah. I'm about to release with the Mahotela Queens a new song called We Have No Choice. Guess who it's about?
Tell us about the process and where does your inspiration come from to write?
Well, you know, having lived in South Africa, which I truly do believe is just a marvelous country full of interesting times and continues to have interesting times. I've got a lot of inspiration from it. You just have to look around, you know, and you get lots of inspiration. I haven't done one of those very fall in and out of love all the time kind of things, so there's not a lot of love songs that come from me, but I can observe other people's broken hearts. And, yeah, no, I can. Don't laugh. I do. And I suppose just through empathy that
there were no broken hearts, would probably have no songs to ever listen to on the radio.
No, but it's true. You know, people keep saying, "When is what's happened to Adele?" I said, "I'll tell you what's happened to Adele. She's had a baby and she's happy." You know, don't be surprised. You know, I continue to write. At the moment, I'm writing with Karin Zoid. We're busy doing, some compilation stuff together. What do you call that stuff when you work together?
Compilation.
No, not compilation. Oh. When you work together.
Co-creation.
Collaboration.
Collaboration. Voila. Okay, there you go.
Collaboration, you know, we're busy doing some collaborations. And there's so much going on, yeah. But I continue to write. Writing is my, there's a line that in my play that says, "Music is a velvet glove, and it allows you to deliver your message of pain, politics, and protest in a way that people will listen." And that is what I do believe of music. And I'm a lucky person in that I do possess that velvet glove of being able to express myself through the writing of my songs.
Well, I think South Africa's glad you can. Because I think many of our lives had PJ's songs as almost as the soundtrack to our lives. So in our youth, I hope there's going to be a soundtrack for our old age too. if you weren't a musician, I get the sense you'd like to be a fashion designer. I mean, we sort of talk about some very strange fashion in the book. I think there was a conversation about, it was sort of Cyndi Lauper meets Zululand. Kind of fashion. Maybe you'd like to talk to us about your fashion inspiration, because there's some mighty strange fashion on YouTube.
Yeah, there is, and there continues to be. I do love, fashion is a horrible word, because it's not fashion. Your fashion is that you all wear an A-line dress when Catherine, what's her name in England, wears one, and that you all wear wedge shoes because suddenly that's the thing. Trends don't really impress me, but style, and because it's an expression of oneself, and I think that is what I'm interested in people in doing, and that's what I do with myself, is try to take from myself and express it outwardly. It's much like my music, so I am interested in doing that, and I would love to do that through a range of clothing, express myself through that. But there's a side to me there's a political animal inside me that could go rah! Very, very easily as well. But, yeah, I mean, they're sort of polar opposites. But
describe some of those very strange outfits. I mean, there was at one stage you were almost looking like Hiawatha. Where did that come from?
Did not look like Hiawatha. I put some feathers in my hair, that's all. No, I think that came from when I toured Malawi and Gamazu Banda. We got these incredible messages through. You weren't allowed to wear pants. And there's no way I could wear a dress on stage. I mean, I kicked my leg up here. And so we got special written permission for me to be able to wear trousers on stage. But they had to be loose and whatever. So I developed a style of harem pants.
Style?
Shut up, man. that's basically those ones. But yes, I did. I combined the ethnic with myself and with bright colors and fun. Fun. That's what life's about, is fun.
If you go and look at some of the YouTube things, you will
certainly
laugh.
No, don't. Don't do that to yourself.
There's some very funny things.
She's just cruel.
Okay, I've got two more quick questions before I open it up to the floor. What was the most moving experience, either that you wrote about in the book or that you've had around the book? Is there something that sort of touched your heart, particularly?
Yeah, I'm a blessed person. With the day that I was given the name Tandeka, is etched in my brain. But I must confess, when I received a letter from Nelson Mandela when he was still in prison, that really that touched me. I felt a combination of pride and just so much, I feel like I'm at the Oscars. So much. It was a new experience. It was a different feeling. So it must have touched me in a way. And then every time I was in his company, I felt a sense of him embracing me. So that was, it was extremely powerful, that.
And he chose you to sing the Rugby World Cup song.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he personally chose me. I wasn't the first choice, and I don't give a damn who was. But he chose me personally, and with together with Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Madiba always had my back. He watched out for me from the day he walked out of prison. From the day we met, I remember he was sitting in the president's box at Ellis Park before he became the president of our country as a welcome home, and he asked to meet me, and he had my back from then. And why, I don't know. I think maybe I told him we were born 2 days apart. Maybe I wasn't so to him, which he enjoyed, and I was quite cheeky with him.
Also said that he knew your music. They were apparently allowed some music within on Robben Island and in Victor Verster. And he loved Jabulani. He said he just used to lift his spirits. So I think that might may be the source of it. My last question to you today is there an appendix to the book? What's lies in the future? Because there's clearly a lot of life left in you. There's a lot of career left in you. So what can we look forward to?
Yeah, I was thinking to myself, there's probably now going to have to be Here I Am Again. because I am doing a lot. I mean, this year I'm going to the United States. I'm going to Australia. I'm writing a play with Marianne Tamp called Driving the Pantechnicon Through the Revolution. There's just so much. There's a movie about the book that's in the offing, a documentary. It's just an explosion. It's incredible. I'm truly blessed and tired. I really am. So will there be an appendix to this book? Probably. I quite like writing. It's actually quite fun. And it's so much more peaceful than being a musician. everybody's so much more laid back. But there you go.
I would like to open it up to the floor. Are there any questions? Yes, I can't really see faces. Is that you, Rudy? Yes. There's a microphone for you.
Thank you so much, Paul. I think it's a wonderful interview. I want to take you back. Right at the outset, you said that everybody loves PJ. Now, I'm sure in the Slatta Odar, there were quite a few guys in government and so on that didn't. I wonder if you could, I don't know if you cover it in the book, but if you could just tell us about were you hassled at any point by the people in blue and others when you became, well, was he?
Yes, I was. I can't say that I wasn't. I was banned. I was under house arrest. Then that was because I couriered. No, that was because I performed at a concert in Zimbabwe for children on the front line, children that had been orphaned because of South Africa's border wars. Children for me are not political, you know. And I came back to South Africa and they slapped a banning order on me and wouldn't play my music. I was in John Foster Square twice. I had bricks and things thrown through my window. The whites at that time viewed me as being a communist. I remember phoning a record store in Witbank and saying to the guy, listen, have you got the new PJ Piles? He said, no, I'm not stocking that communist. I don't stock her. She's a communist. Communist. I'm the biggest capitalist on the planet. Anyway, I had a lot of flack. I had no support. Yes, I was not liked. I was on the 100 list. They wanted to take me out. Myself and Jennifer Ferguson were the two musicians that were on that list of people. And I know that my phone was tapped. And it was a very difficult time for me. Because like that, my world became a different one. A wonderful one. But I suddenly had lost my base, you know, what I'd been used to my entire, for that very short time career, was suddenly turned on its head and it became completely different, you know.
In fact, when Marianne was doing research for the book, she went to the SABC to get some old footage, and I believe that she there found an old LP with a big black sticker saying "band" with "band" taped on it.
Do not play. Which
yeah,
is not
do
all
not
I
play.
Say.
And so for a musician to have an instruction not to play your music, I mean, in the end, how do you get your music out if the radio stations won't play it? So it had profound impact.
Yeah, and strangely enough, it lasted, you know. It lasted for a while because it was only after 95, after the 95 World Cup, that, I don't know, suddenly I was allowed back in to the white world, you know. But prior to that, it was quite difficult. Because it was neither here nor there. I was like, ooh, yeah, I'm on this tightrope, you know.
Any other questions? Yes. Here comes the microphone.
You said you love justice.
Yes, I do.
What injustices do you help eradicate?
What injustice?
At present, in present South Africa, you like to sing about to recognize?
Well, you see, I would never sing about injustice because it's you know.
No.
But what I will do is how to rectify the injustices is to create more justice, as opposed to you know, some other Teresa. I won't fight against something. I will march for something. And so, what I would like to do is, you know, I'm very, very pro the act of citizenship. And in order to eliminate injustices, we have to create more justice. And I think we can do that by Wayne Duvenage, for example, is a beacon of hope and light for me, that the injustice of toll roads, they still are fighting about this. I don't think they'll ever get it through, because he took it upon himself to take the people on, the government on. And the injustice of you know, I mean, I'm horrified that the entire budget speech was about development. And I mean, I did a tweet saying, you know, have there been any developments on the subject of development about finding the people that have stolen taxpayers' money? That would probably actually be able to alleviate all the problems. You wouldn't have to increase the taxes. So speak out, use your voice, don't sit inside your home and armchair politics. You know, it doesn't work. The way to nullify injustice is by speaking out, and now by not getting tired and not having the attitude of makes no difference if I say anything. It does. Mm. One voice makes a difference. That is the root.
And are there any other questions? But I think that's a wonderful note to end this today on. I think that's what PJ stands for, and I trust that as you read her book and uncover the real person, you will understand her journey more profoundly. Thank you so much, PJ,
thank
for this lovely interview.
Thank you.
From my side, I just want to say thank you so much. What a fascinating conversation. I'm so glad. I'm sure all of you are so glad you're here today. And been here.
Put up your hands if you're glad you were here.
All of you, please. I just want to remind you that the book is on sale. So it is here. You can just move out through here to the Artikafir Boekwinkel. It's there, and PJ will be signing books there as well right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.